You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a fire ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
You're listening to The Spear, the podcast about the combat experience, brought to you by the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm your host, Tim Heck, and today I'm joined by Chris LaRue, who's a professor of military science at Montana State University and a lieutenant colonel in the Army. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks. Pleasure.
All right, traditional first question. How'd you wind up in the Army?
Lifelong dream. I watched too many John Wayne movies as a young and impressionable child, and I wanted to do that, and so I enlisted in the Army National Guard because at the time I didn't think I had what it took. Who knew? And then I went to college and got a commission. I've been on active duty like 24 years, 23 and a half.
All right. So John Wayne movies, cowboy wasn't the option, so you went with soldier.
Right. Well, so we'll split the difference, right? She wore a yellow ribbon. You can see the Stetson and the cab stuff in the back, right? So, yeah.
So you're an armor officer.
I am. Yep.
And what was that training pipeline like for you coming in now in the pre-9/11 days?
So pre-9/11, there's a lot of Back to the Future, if you will. There's, when we came in, we spent a lot of time looking at Russia, but we hadn't really, you know, we just took all the old Soviet stuff and we kind of relabeled it all Russian stuff. And that training pipeline as a lieutenant in the armor basic leader course, which back then was our officer basic course, was really all about like how to operate the tank, how to get the, you know, how do you operate the platoon, and how do you fight against a pure threat, right? Against the Soviet horde, except it was relabeled Russia. And as you know, as most of us know, that quickly changed in 2001. But in 99, when I came in, it was really all focused on that high intensity war back when we called it that.
You mentioned right the Back to the Future. We've come back through this, right? Large scale combat operations, the new FM3-0 operations, but you grew up in a very different army. What was your pipeline after armor basic course?
So I went to the armor basic course, and my first assignment out of that was to the 1st Battalion, 35th Armor in Baumholder, Germany. And so, you know, our senior NCOs, my first job, I spent a few months turning my wheels as the assistant HHC XO, right? So I was this new second lieutenant helping out a very, very senior first lieutenant run the headquarters company, which in an armored battalion back then was 350 people, 325, something like that, with disparate groups, right? You had the staff, you had the scouts and the mortars, you had maintenance, you had this support platoon, this logistics platoon. That's all changed these days. And then I kind of learned, it was good opportunity to learn how the whole system worked. And you quickly figure out, particularly on tanks, like none of those guys do any of that stuff alone. And those officers have to understand logistics and maintenance. And that was a great opportunity. I went from there after 3 or 4 months, And they put me into a tank platoon, and we were focused on maintaining the vehicles and operating the vehicles. We spent a ton of time in the motor pool and a ton of time in the tank, just going through crew drills and learning those basic things. And as a new lieutenant, it was funny. I mean, your NCOs, my platoon sergeant, they were all Desert Storm vets, right? So my platoon sergeant had earned a Silver Star in Desert Storm. And, you know, he was looked at by many, he was a master gunner, many as like, this is what we aspire to, that 100-hour war. That's what we aspire to be. We're going to shoot 40 rounds, 40 hits out of this tank.
So you're a brand new lieutenant. You've shown up. You have this larger than life, possibly platoon sergeant, right? He's got a Silver Star. He was in Desert Storm. He's not exactly a lightweight. How did your interactions with him work out?
So we were, there's an old saying, right, in the military, better lucky than good. I was lucky. So him and I went into the platoon right at the same time, right before we went to tank gunnery. And so tank gunnery back then was really the most important thing we did as tankers. And that's from a platoon leader's perspective. You know, arguably there's a combined arms, live fire type stuff is super important. But as a PL, that's what I thought the most important thing was. So we come in together and that meant we didn't have any preconceived notions about what we were going to do. And what I did was I wanted to start this relationship. I wanted to understand, hey, what did he expect of me? What did I expect of him? So, you know, we teach cadets as they're going to become officers, as I do in my with my seniors here. Like, hey, you know, you got to counsel your platoon sergeant. But the reality is, what that looked like for me was sitting down with him before there was any paper, and it was just like, hey, how do we want to do this? Like, what does right look like for you? And what do you expect of me? It took a little humility to say that, right? So I'm asking somebody that I'm supposed to be in charge with, right? That I've learned over the last, both your basic course and an ROTC, hey, you're the lieutenant, you're in charge, and you're responsible, right? When you get there, your battalion commander, mine, I still remember him. He was like, hey, you're the lieutenant, you're responsible. But you know, I innately knew that that this is the guy that knows what right looks like. Anyway, so we kind of put together a game plan of really, we started to focus on training first. We're going to gunnery. We are both new. We're going to have to do a platoon live fire at the end of this. Back then it was called Tank Table 12, something new today. But and how are we going to take the next 3 to 4 weeks and sort of like plan that out so that when we get to that live fire portion that we're operating really well as a platoon? And a lot of it had to do with these conversations about, hey, you're going to do A and I'm going to do B. You're going to do this and I'm going to do that. It was never, ever any conversation about like, well, that's officer business and that's NCO business. It was all, hey, I'm going to take this responsibility, you take that. And there was a lot of crosstalk. And I think I benefited from that. We were both new to the platoon that we got that. Like, we had to crosstalk. So we go out to gunnery and there's a particular thing that sticks in my head. So as a new tech PL, one of the things that you're supposed to do is fire control and distribution. So you got to run sectors of fire. And I can remember the first time we were in a little training area and I was like, okay, you know, blue one, you see that big tree on the left? You go from the big tree on the left to the big rock. And I laid it all out. And then there was silence on the net for a second. And my platoon sergeant comes on and he's like, hey, blue one, I don't think any of us understand what you're talking about. So those tank commanders, so two staff sergeants and my platoon sergeant, probably spent the next 2 hours and we just rolled up onto an IV line and then I would do sectors of fire and they did it again and again. And then finally, when they're I'm actually describing things that they can visualize, right? That the words I'm using actually relate to their, in their tank. They're like, oh yeah, I see the thing that he's talking about. And that, we did a bunch of little stuff like that. Every time we had opportunity to get out and do stuff as a team, we did. We spent another day, literally, I think it was a 2x2 kilometer box with the platoon. And we just drove from one side to the next and then this side. And we would change formations and we'd go back and forth and back. And again, this is all predicated on this high intensity fight, right? It wasn't this training that, like, later on in my career that we really focused on. And then when we ended up to the platoon live fire, it was phenomenal. And it was phenomenal. We did a good job, despite things going wrong, but it was because we knew what everybody was going to do. The way it starts off is the platoon sergeant's going to call for fire on this, you know, target that's way out there. And of course, his radios don't work. So then I'm calling for fire and I wasn't prepared. You know, I didn't write anything, you know, and I'm like, oh, so I, you know, pull out your smart book and you lay out the map. But we worked through that one thing. But because we had done all this little stuff together, while I was doing that, my wingman took care of the sector that I was dealing with, and so on and so forth. But that is a long answer to your question. But man, I forgot those days.
The teamwork aspect that you and your platoon sergeant and you and those two tank commanders seem to have built, did you wind up going with that anywhere?
Yeah. So so we did a couple things. We were selected to be the breach platoon in a battalion live fire, which, you know, I look back and I'm like, ooh, that was a real proud moment for us, working with other groups. And then eventually our unit was slotted to go do peacekeeping in the Balkans. And we were one of the platoons that was sent in a remote site where it was just an outpost in the northern part of our sector.
Peacekeeping in the Balkans, something that, you know, was a blip on the radar in the 1990s, early 2000s, but most of our listeners probably have no idea what you're talking about. What was going on? Where were you going?
Yeah, so a small space where we decided as a nation that we were going to put American troops, soldiers, Marines, airmen, sailors, in between two groups of people that desperately wanted to kill each other. And so we went to this little place, this little province called Kosovo, which had been part of Serbia. They had fought a civil war, essentially, in that part of the region. And there was a peace accord that was which sent NATO forces in to Kosovo. The Serbians backed off, and our job was really to stabilize and then transition control back over to the locals. And when I say stabilize, so when the Serbians left, they left under duress because NATO kind of pushed them out. And our job was to hold that ground, to deter them from coming back in. But then there was all kinds of civil strife internal to that, right? And so for those that are familiar with the, you know, coin of the last 20 years, there's some aspects of it that are like that. The rebuilding of civil society type stuff. But there was far less violence. And the violence generally was not directed toward us. It was directed toward others, each other.
So an interesting segue, right? You've talked about high intensity conflict and being the breach platoon and gunnery. And now all of a sudden are you in your tanks in Kosovo?
Yeah. So we get to Kosovo. We have tanks. We also have four Humvees. We get some attachments, a handful of medical folks, and really what we're, I can even remember part of the phrase, like the mission statement was, the purpose was so that Kosovars can determine their own future. I think it was a safe and secure environment, blah, blah, blah. So the Kosovars can determine their own future. And our job was safe and secure environment, right? And so we would use tanks sometimes and do patrols in a section of tanks, two tanks driving down the road. This isn't always ideal, right? Because a 70-ton tank, even with its ground pressure, might, you know, destroy culverts and ruins roads and stuff. So, but sometimes you're trying to intimidate folks, and a tank can bring an edge and intimidation. But then we would also jump in Humvees and drive around. So we did a lot of patrolling, and I think at the time we got wrapped in this idea of presence patrol, you know, just show presence, kind of like cops on the street to deter crime. And that was kind of amorphous as a lieutenant, a young lieutenant. And I was still a second lieutenant when I ended up there. And we were put on this remote site in this town that was half Albanian, half Serbian, right? So you have the not only the ethnic divide, but there's a religious divide. There actually was a gold mine in the town an American firm was trying to reopen with this group. That was an interesting economic aspect. There were some UN, HCR, the group from the UN that deals with refugees. And so we were kind of, there was this a whole bunch of different folks that all had their own objectives and really had their own history that they brought with it, right? The Serbs looked at everything one way, the Albanians a different way, the UN a third way, right? Us as military forces, a fourth way, right? Like, we just went through all this training about high intensity conflict. And then we went to this short rotation about, hey, you're going to go do some peacekeeping right now. Fantastic. Great. We did that at Hohenfels training area for a couple weeks, and then we ship off. And now we're trying to, as a combat arms platoon, trying to do peacekeeping. We don't really know what that means. We have an understanding, but there's a lot of latitude as a lieutenant to, as a junior leader, particularly because you're away from the flagpole. I mean, my flagpole, my company commander was an hour and a half away.
That's a haul. And I guess the question that I want to ask is, what guidance did you receive from him prior to occupying that position in that town?
I'm pulling some strings from far back, from the Wayback Machine. I think the biggest thing we were, when we first got there, we're trying to do is, I mean, we replaced the unit that was there. Again, much like what the template that we all kind of saw over the last 20 years. So replace the unit was there. And our job really was to protect, was that safe and secure environment. So defuse situations, de-escalate things, show force in order to intimidate others to prevent those first two, right? You don't want to minimize violence. And then assist. There was a third piece to this wheel. There was a UN police force that was trying to stand up a local police force and assist them in sort of standing up this ground roots public security thing. And then we did stuff on the side, on the fringes, and that many, many folks that worked in GWAT would be familiar with. So we worked on, you know, construction projects, and, you know, we funneled money and we funneled aid. There was aid coming in from, I remember one time they dropped like 2 40-foot mill vans full of like clothes, right? So you do these clothes things. So you're handing out sort of that kind of stuff. But that was really on the fringes. Our job really was to minimize the amount of violence that was occurring. We did, for the most part, that was relatively easy. I say relative because I say that with the hindsight of 20 years of COIN, which that was really, really hard in COIN. Far different here.
The company commander's an hour and a half away, which by default makes you the senior man, which makes your platoon sergeant relationship even more valuable and more crucial to the success of your platoon, right?
Yeah.
What conversations are you having with him? Because this is radically different than what you've already prepared for.
Yeah, I think you can't underestimate how powerful that relationship is with your senior NCOs, particularly at the lieutenant level, right? At the platoon leader level, because I don't remember the quote, but there's a great quote by Eisenhower talks about how the lieutenant is the one officer that works directly with enlisted soldiers. Every other officer, their subordinates are other officers, junior officers. But as a lieutenant, it's soldiers. And it took work, right? So the first thing is, in Kosovo, I remember distinctly having a conversation with I don't even remember what it was about, but my platoon sergeant and I have this conversation, and I said, I want to go left. And he's like, sir, I think we should go right. And I was like, well, here's why I think left is better. So I kind of list off the stuff. And he's like, well, sir, I think right. And I'm like, okay. He's like, but sir, you're the lieutenant. Like, if you want to go left, we'll go left. And I was like, whoa, wait. Like, I want you to go left, not because I'm the lieutenant. I want you to go left because you think it's the way to do it. And he's like, well, sir, you're in charge. Like, it's okay. Left will work. I just think right's better. And that conversation, that's when I knew I had arrived. Like, and I And I say arrived like it was done. I didn't like, you know, I didn't plant a flag on the top of the hill at that point, but I knew the relationship that I had with my platoon sergeant was awesome. If there's one thing I look back on and I think that I had was this idea of sincerity, like I was just me. I was being me, and I did what I thought was right, and I included the people that were with me, and I think I included those people that were in with me, and I took responsibility for what was mine. You're in Kosovo. All of that relationship mattered. All of that built into this idea of trust between people, and trust is, you know, it's a bunch of things, but it's that feeling that you have when you're talking to somebody else, like, yeah, I feel like this person's sincere. And that comes, some of us, we've all met people, right? And right off the bat, you don't trust somebody because you didn't have that feeling. And then some people you meet, shake hands with them, and you trust them almost immediately. That's one piece of it, right? There's, I think, other stuff that's involved too, but that was something that helped me as a lieutenant.
What was daily life like in Kosovo on these patrols and interacting with the locals and the UN and a mining corporation?
I mean, daily life was, in a lot of ways, it was very similar to the GWAT piece. But you didn't have the constant threat of attack. We spent generally every day, we had a patrol schedule. So we do 1 to 2 mounted patrols and a dismounted patrol. So our little outpost of 18 people, 19 people, was in a village that was maybe 300-400 people. One end of the village was Serbian and the other Albanian. And the gold mine and the UN were out on the edge of the Albanian side. And so we would do a dismounted patrol. We would, you know, play soccer with some kids while we were out there. There were relatively small groups. We talked to folks. And then the mounted patrols, we'd go to these other villages that were near us. So generally you'd wake up in the morning pretty early. We ring a guard. Obviously there was a guard mount to protect us. So that was that 24-hour cycle. Wake up in the morning, we would have a radio call with our company command post back Camp Monteith, which was, like I said, about an hour and a half away. And then we'd run the patrol schedule. Every afternoon, we'd drive back to Monteith, and that would give us an opportunity to get parts, supplies, and then we would Mermite chow back in, and we'd bring the old Mermite. So there was this, generally every single day we would run that route. And then occasionally we would go out for night patrols. And then at the time, there was far fewer of those. And I think, you know, I look back and I think, well, we probably, to be more effective, we should have done more at night, but we didn't. And then all of that was sort of the humdrum routine. And then occasionally we get called to do stuff. Hey, there's an incident, there's a rally at a particular village, and we're afraid that it might, you know, it might get violent. You should go there. And so there was pro-Serb and then pro-Albanian rallies in certain places. We'd go there, or there might be an incident where the UN police, and so there'd be an international police officer, pick a country, they were from all over, with some local police officers somewhere, and they wanted some backup, you know, whether they were doing a lot of smuggling, stuff like that. And so we'd go that.
The situation in Kosovo, though, wasn't just the UN and the United States, right? The other side, the Serbs, had a historic relationship with Russia. Did you wind up encountering Russians?
Yeah. So the Russians, initially, the historical context, right, is NATO has this air war against Serbia that forces withdrawal of Serbians from the Kosovo province into Serbia proper. And then the Russians helo into Pristina, which is the capital of Kosovo, helo in some forces and get ahead of us. And eventually we work out this deal. And I say we, not me, not Lieutenant LaRue. NATO, Russia, the world, the UN, whomever it is, works out this deal where the Russians have a sector. And so the Russian tactical group was actually to the east of where my platoon was located. And just to our north, we had the Brits. And so the Russians were very pro-Serb. And the Russians actually would escort school children from their sector to a school in our sector, and then back again. And they would do these, you know, they would walk the school kids to school and then walk them back in the afternoon. And that would put them in our sector. And occasionally they would act out. There was one instance that I remember where, and there was a two events that were, that I thought were unrelated, or the first event, I didn't think anything. I thought it was kind of this bizarre thing, but then eventually related to another event. So what happened was, so we had this drunk older gentleman show up to our little outpost. And this happened, every so often someone would show up asking for medical attention because we had some army medics. And so this guy shows up and he's wasted. He's also beat up. And his story is this bizarre story about these Russian soldiers beating him up. And we're like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Like, there's no Russians here. Like, what are you talking about? The Russians are far, far on the other side. At the time, we had no idea that they were walking school kids into our AO because they're not supposed to be in our AO. So, we're like, huh. So we report that up to our chain of command and we say, hey, you know, we probably should look into this. But the guy is not a super credible person, which, you know, that's another bag that you could unpack at the time. But that was the assessment that I made at the time. And we figured we report it and kind of move on. And then a few days later, we find out that there's these Russians in this town. And they had just, what we were told is they had just raped a woman. And so we're like, oh. And so we pile up in our Humvees, or we grab a section, we roll out to this town to go see what's going on. And we get there, and there are, in fact, four Russian soldiers in this like corner store sort of cafe, drinking the local rakia, which is like plum schnapps, essentially. And so we start talking to them and we're like, hey, what's going on? And then as that's going on, one of the locals comes up and grabs one of us, my staff sergeant, who then comes and grabs me. And then so we kind of rotate and tells a story about how there's this woman in this house and these Russian soldiers were kicking in doors and they sexual assaulted her. But then he says, But the woman was not raped, right? And so she got away. And so we're very confused. And so this whole thing, and now, I report this up, and my boss says to me, hey, I want you to keep the Russian soldiers there. And I'm like, okay, so I don't know quite what that means or what. He's like, buy me some time. And I'm like, all right, boss, I got you. So we, you know, I tell my staff sergeant, I'm like, hey, we just need to keep engaging these soldiers and just keep them here. The hire is trying to figure out what they want to do. And what I don't know at the time is they're trying to figure out, like, can we get the military police there? Can we contact the Russian unit? But as a young lieutenant, I'm not sure, you know, I don't know what's really happening at that level. Well, so over there, we're talking to these Russian soldiers, and what we tease out of this thing is that this whole assault happened a couple days previously. Shockingly, it lines up to when this drunk guy that was beat up had showed up to get medical attention, but that some of the soldiers that were there during that day and then some were not. And so we're piecing this stuff up to our headquarters. And again, we're trying to keep them there and keep them engaged, and they want to leave. We're like, no, you got to stay. And so eventually they're like, we're going to go. And so as this is approaching, I tell my boss, I'm like, hey, you know, I think, you know, Comanche 6, this is Blue 1, like, they're going to leave unless you want me to use force to keep them. Like, they're done. I can't keep them any longer. And he's like, no, you're not authorized to use force. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know what you want me to do. We're supposed to enforce law and, you know, safe and secure environment. But if you're not going to let me use force to keep them, they're gone. This goes on for about 30, 45 minutes. And finally they leave. And you know, as they're walking away, because they walked there, I get on the net and I'm like, to our command post, and I tell the radio operator, hey, they're departing. I'm watching them as they leave the valley. And then maybe about 45, as soon as they leave the valley, we get another note that says, another radio transmission that says, hey, you need to keep them there. You're authorized to use force. And I said, that's great. They're gone now. Maybe 10 minutes after that, the military police show up and they say, hey, we're here to arrest these people for this assault. And so, we're very confused, right? And so the other lieutenant from the MP platoon and myself, we kind of talk and we're like, well, they're gone. Like they walked that, 2 kilometers, 1500 meters into that wood line, and they're off the other side. There is a trail we can take. So we're like, okay, well, he's going to call his boss. I'm going to call mine, figure out what we want to do. And they come back, both of us get word, like, you need to go into the Russian sector, find those 4 soldiers and arrest them and bring them back to Camp Monte for questioning. And so we're like, all right, roger that.
You've just been authorized to use force against guys who have left. All of this discussion of force then begs the question of what were your understandings of the use of force in a peacekeeping situation, right? Again, we've talked about GWAT here, and like the first thing that happens when you get in country, other than going, oh God, it's hot, is a rules of engagement law of war brief. What happened in Kosovo?
So we had the same. We had a rules of engagement law of war brief. So when you go to Iraq or Afghanistan, you fight in a declared war, you get a white card. They call it white card ROE. Your ROE is on a little white card. In Kosovo, we got what was called a blue card ROE. And I probably have it somewhere still. But it was a rules of engagement that we were authorized to use. And it had the same inherent right to self-defense that we had in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think the main difference in that ROE card is in Iraq, Afghanistan, you have designated groups that are designated as enemy combatants, right? So like in the march up in 2003, for example, you were authorized to use lethal force against any uniformed member of the Iraqi army, for example. Now, obviously that changes over time, right? When there's no uniforms anymore. But that was sort of the white card piece. And the blue card, I don't remember all the details. I do remember the authorization to use force to protect life. And if I vaguely remember, there was authorizations if somebody were stealing something like a weapon. You couldn't use lethal force if they were stealing your Humvee or if there were no weapons in it. But if they were stealing, your M240, then you could use force. But it was also a graduated force, right? You weren't authorized to use lethal force up front. However, when dealing with the Russians, who are part of the coalition in the peacekeeping force, there was nothing that laid out what the rules of the use of force were against other people that were in that coalition, right? So, I mean, we often work with the Swedes, the Brits. We saw the Germans and the Poles every once in a while. Obviously, the Russians. I think if I go back to Second Lieutenant LaRue, I think in my head I thought of it as a police action, meaning the MPs, much like the MPs could use force to detain a soldier who's drunk and belligerent, I thought of it in those terms. But I do remember using that terminology about, hey, if you want us to keep them, you're gonna have to authorize us to use force as a way to say, like, hey, like this is not something that we should look at lightly. We're talking about detaining or arresting, 4 soldiers that are armed with rifles.
So what happened?
Yeah, it's great. So by the time the other lieutenant and I got word, like, no, go after him. We're like, great. You're authorized to use force. We're like, okay. So I'm like, hey, you're the law enforcement guy. You take the lead. I'll back you up. And he's like, well, you know the area. You lead us out there, and then we'll take actions on, right? Got it. So we roll out, and now it's dark. I didn't mention this earlier, but it's wintertime in Kosovo. So it's like sleety, slushy, rainy kind of weather. So we're rolling down the road, and we're sort of like Hansel and Gretel. Like, we're not going to see anybody. We're not expecting to see anybody. There's not electricity, right? You're on this very, pretty narrow tract. Some farm fields on one side, woods on the other. And then a vehicle starts coming toward us. And so the vehicle's coming toward us. I recognize that it's a BTR-80. So that's an eight-wheeled Russian armored car with a 14.5-millimeter gun and a turret on the top. And I report that on the radio, and I get told, Roger, you are authorized to use force. Well, I'm not rolling around in an M1. I'm rolling around in a Humvee with a 240 on the turret, and it's not even armored. It's before those days. So at this point, my driver looks at me, and he's like, use force, sir? And I'm like, yeah, let's just get out and talk to these guys, because clearly we're not using force against, you know, an APC. We get out. And I hear a distinctly American voice screaming at the top of their lungs, who the F is in charge? Who's in charge? And a bunch of Russian soldiers come out from the back. And then there's one American, and it's a major. And I report to the major. I'm still Second Lieutenant LaRue. So, like, you know, I'm like in the position of attention and salute. And he's like, what the hell are you doing? And he was the... He was the liaison officer. He was an SF liaison officer to the Russian tactical group. And with him is like their version of a command star major, like the personnel focused guy at the group level. And they're looking for these four soldiers too. And he's like, we got it. So, and then everything de-escalates, and he's like, all right, great. You know, the major says, Second Lieutenant, great work. You got out here. And, you know, we gave him the whole story, the pieces that we had pieced together over the course of the day, the guy who had been beat up a couple days ago. Because at this point, I think it was only me and the MP lieutenant that had any idea really what the scope of everything that had happened, because, all those reports are coming in bits and pieces, right? So I'm sure the CP, you know, in hindsight, I know this. The CP is putting together sentence after sentence, but that doesn't build you a paragraph, if that makes any sense. So we get with them, we kind of lay out the whole timeline. The major, kind of tells us, hey, this is what we're going to do. We know where those people are, blah, blah, blah. We call back hire says, great, Major so-and-so's got it. You guys are relieved. You can come back to your, back to the camp, Monty for the MPs. And then that was that. But I will be, you think of the absurdity of some of this stuff. They're like, yes, you're authorized to use force. Did you not get my report that it's a BTR-80 and we're in Humvees? I'm pretty sure we shouldn't be using force at this point. At this point, like, discretion is the better part of valor. But some of those are the things that you're going to decide because you're the person on the ground.
This all happens within 6 months of you showing up to your unit.
Yeah, I would say probably... month four or five is probably about right.
You get back in your vehicles, you head back to the camp. There's got to be an adrenaline dump at some point, right? You were about to use force to apprehend four Russian soldiers. What happens once you get back to camp?
Yeah. So, I mean, just pulling on the thread, I don't remember exactly like when we showed up. So we had this, we were in like this old theater. It wasn't a large place, but we had this sort of like lounge area where we would eat, and we had like, you know, old couch and some folding chairs or whatever. And I distinctly, so I had two soldiers, Housie and Fisher. And I distinctly remember like Fisher being like, what the hell was that? And I remember talking a little bit about like, well, you know, our job is safe and secure, and that's what we're trying to do. And what does force mean? Hell if I know, but we sure as hell weren't going to use force to, like to detain the BTR. I mean, I think really there was this, I said a little earlier about like the driver, which was Fisher, was my driver, who looked at me like, we're not doing, you know, when we roll up to the BTR and they're like, yes, remember you're authorized to use force. I'm like, Roger that, six. And and you're like, and he looks at me and I'm like, yeah, let's just go figure out what's going on. And so we sort of unpacked, like, were you really going to use force, sir? I'm like, well, that would have been you, but I'm pretty sure that 14.5 wasn't going to do much for, like, that's more intimidating. And so we had this conversation. Where did it go? I don't know that it really went anywhere. Otherwise, we sort of just unpacked, like, that was crazy, right? Like, what were we going to do with that? Had we run into the four soldiers, that would have been, that also would have been crazy. But I think, I look back. And it actually makes me think now, like, man, had we rolled up on those four soldiers and drawn down on them, that's crazy too. Were we really, to be honest with you, I don't think I have an answer. I don't think I, as a lieutenant, anticipated that we were going to ever have to pull the trigger, which obviously later on in my career changed, right? Like the GWAT changed a lot of that, but
it sounds like you had a series of like, what now, lieutenant moments, right? What do I do? I ask for guidance. What do I do? Well, detain them. Well, don't detain them, but let them go. Like, you have this, you know, as I'm kind of looking at the roadmap of this story, these places where you could have gone left or you could have gone right. And that takes us back to that conversation with the platoon sergeant. Did you talk to him about this afterwards?
Yeah. I mean, I think in the end, the feeling, I don't remember what we said, to be honest with you. I think the feeling, I walked away from that feeling like I couldn't make a bad decision, which is not true, right? Like, obviously you can. But what I mean by that is, like, no matter what decision I made, they were going to back my play. They trusted me enough. And I think some of it comes back to, we weren't blindly following orders, right? We were providing information, and then they're like, hey, keep them there. Well, if you want us to keep them there, we got to use force. Otherwise they're going to leave. And at one point, I think over the radio, after they had left, I got my butt chewed, an FM ass chewing because I let them go. And I was like, but you said I can't use force. So they're mutually exclusive, right? I just remember feeling after that, there was, my platoon sergeant and I were a tight team, and really the whole platoon. And you ever talk about, like, or think about the, you know, teams are made when groups of people overcome shared adversity. And the unknown in this whole thing was the adversity. It wasn't that it was too cold or, you know, you were up to your armpits and hand grenade pins. It was like, what are we going to do next? I don't know. We're going to figure it through and just back the LT's play. And I was lucky that I had some people that, you know, I didn't doubt for a second. Now that I think back, I didn't doubt for a second. I don't know what would have happened had we run into those four soldiers. I don't know. I don't know if I've ever contemplated that before just now, you know. But I do know that my team would have backed me up. And that's a humbling thing to feel, even right now, even 20-something years later.
We've circled back to an event from the beginning of your career, and you talked about how old is new again at the intro to the episode, right? High intensity conflict is now LISCO. You are in the commissioning pipeline. You are kind of the last wicket for these students at Montana, these cadets at Montana State. What advice do you give them as they prepare to go out to face LISCO or other possibilities like you did in the late 90s?
Yeah. I think, you know, as you might imagine, I get to be with cadets for a whole year, really focused at that senior year on officership. And I think really ROTC really focuses you on the basics up until year three, right? It's all about your summer cadet training and advanced camp. And But that senior year, we put him in charge. And I like to talk to him about things like having a growth mindset, like being a profession. We just talked about this in class the other day too, but being a profession is about like knowing that you're always going to learn. There's always something to learn. You've never arrived. You don't get there. I'm not get there. I told cadets this summer, actually at summer training, I said, you know, you guys are, when they graduate, you guys are one step closer to leading America's sons and daughters, but guess what? You're not worthy. And of course, you know, I'm a lieutenant colonel and they're juniors going to be seniors. And like, what do you mean I'm not worthy? I'm like, you are not, nobody in this room is worthy to lead America's sons and daughters. Neither am I. And it's something that we have to continually work towards. You got to be that much better tomorrow than you were today. And if there was one thing I would say is have this idea that you're continually, you have to continue to learn your profession, because we're in a profession that you can do everything right by the book, everything right, even from a judgment perspective, and still people can get killed. And so, you know, the lesson I look back when you talk to Hick Talisco and that space in between, which was coin and maybe a little peacekeeping up front. I mean, what links all that together is this growth mindset. It's this idea that I'm going to constantly learn and adapt and learn and adapt and learn and adapt. And what made us successful, I think, in peacekeeping was the, you know, it wasn't mission command back then, but this idea that of how you're going to lead and this philosophy of collaboration with expertise in different groups and bringing that together. And as an Army leader, and it doesn't matter if you're an officer or a non-commissioned officer, it's bringing that collective expertise together. I love to tell cadets, hey, all of us are smarter than just one of us. I'm not the smartest person in the room. I just have more experience than everybody. I said that as a squadron commander, as a staff, all of us are smarter than just me. Right. So let's leverage that. And if that's one thing, and there's probably a ton more, but that's one thing that I can't underscore enough.
Well, Chris, thanks for telling us an unusual story today about a time that I think most of us have forgotten.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.